Scientists have heard her just huge, unusual messages from deep in space that they think are coming from aliens. A new analysis of strange modulations in a tiny set of stars appears to indicate that it could be coming from extraterrestrial intelligence that is looking to alert us, maybe, to their existence. A new study reports the findings of specific modulations in just 234 out of 2.5 million stars that have been observed during a survey of the sky. The work found that a tiny fraction of them seem to be behaving strangely, and there appears to be no obvious explanation for what is going on, leaving the scientists behind the paper to conclude that the messages might be coming from aliens. It's an amazing story. The research has been accepted for publication in the journal Publications of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific under the title Signals Probably from Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Well, what does this all mean? In a moment, we'll be talking with Dr. Seth Shostak, of course, from the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They've got some of their own work under, and we're going to find out more about what his thoughts are on this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Seth Shostak is the senior astronomer and director of the Center for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Research. He also has degrees from Princeton and Caltech. He's written more than 400 popular magazine articles, newspapers, and web stories. He hosts the SETI Institute's science radio show, Big Picture Science, a number of books, including Confessions of an Alien Hunter. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, Seth.
It's my pleasure, George.
Now, these strange stories coming from all over the place, that they're beginning to hear things and strange modulations, as they call them. What do you think's going on?
Yeah, well, it is kind of an interesting time, I guess. The kind of times that I guess the Chinese said you would be pleased to live in, where a lot of things have been happening in the past couple of months. There's this story you just mentioned about the claims that there's some modulation, some change in the brightness of stars that affects, you know, 284 of them, or whatever the number is. That's a very controversial claim, I have to say. But there have been also things like Tabby Star, which has been in the news for, I don't know, 5 or 6 months, mm-hmm. more. And you know, we still don't understand what's going on there. There was the discovery of a planet around our nearest other star, you know, Proxima Centauri, a planet that might be habitable. That's an interesting story. And then there's this Russian signal that popped up a couple of weeks ago. So I think it's nothing more than coincidence, but it is true that there have been a lot of stories.
Well, and SETI is out there listening for these signals. So they've got the Paul Allen array of telescopes up there trying to do this. So I would guess that some of this is probable. Most people would say, nah, it's an anomaly, it doesn't exist. But, I mean, SETI folks are actually out there listening, too, so maybe there's something to these stories.
Well, that's the thing. I have to say, when you first hear about, you know, the claim that somebody thinks they've got good evidence, you know, for a cosmic company out there, you tend to be skeptical because you've heard it many, many times, and, you know, from our point of view, it's never turned out to be true. But on the other hand, you know, there is the danger that you will throw out the infant with the bathing liquid. So, in order to avoid that, I mean, obviously, if people, such as that Russian signal, that's a good example, it, you know, right from the beginning, it sounded a little suspicious to me, but doggone it, we spent a couple of days using the Allen Telescope Array to try and check it out. I mean, that's what you got to do because you don't want to miss one. So, that's true. Skeptical at first, but then you know, you apply the telescope time when you think that the evidence is looking pretty good.
You got to check into it. Indeed. Do you think something one day will be found?
Well, that's the whole idea. Yeah, the idea is not to just, you know, poo-poo everything that comes up, but to eventually find something. I mean, that's the point of the whole experiment.
If they're using that kind of technology, one of the arguments about what SETI's been doing is that you might be listening for real old technology, and that now they've got some higher stuff. But that's not the point. The issue is you want to hear something.
Well, that's true. I mean, that argument, that doggone it, and, you know, I get emails, George, just about every week from people saying, I mean, I get emails every day, of course, but I mean, get the, this particular email maybe once a week or so where people will say, you know, radio, that's so old school. I mean, the aliens won't be using it. Now, I'm sure you don't like to hear
No, comments, I hate that.
Well, so do I. There you go. And it's, you know, I always have to turn the question around and say, well, what's new school? I mean, what? And sometimes they'll say, well, you should be, you know, looking for gravity waves. And so then I have to tell them why I don't think that's a great idea. Or neutrinos. Or they have some idea. Some of them will just say, well, the aliens have hyperdimensional physics or whatever, right, which is something that you can't get a textbook for that. And if you can't explain how it works, you really are hard up to design any equipment that allow you to do an experiment. So you do the experiment with the kind of technology that you understand, the kind of physics you understand.
Well, this study that I just read of the 234 stars out of 2.5 million, and that they're finding some specific strange sounds, is it a legit study?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I have to say, I'm personally aware of the fact that there have been 6 referees for that paper. And, you know, these guys you can't dismiss these guys. They've done this study. They seem to be competent. But there are always dangers in a study like that where you're looking for a very subtle effect in a very large number, in this case millions, you know, of star systems, and you find it in some of them because the observations were somewhat indirect, or at least the results were somewhat indirect. They didn't take the kind of observations that would show them directly that these stars are behaving funny in the way they claim. And consequently, where you can fall victim is some sort of very subtle instrumentation effect or some error in your analysis. And the referees for this paper, it was submitted to, as I say, 5 or 6 other journals that rejected the paper.
Ah.
So, you know.
That's good to know.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's not something you're going to, in general, know, indeed, at all, because, you know, you just see the paper appears in some journal, and you don't hear about the other journals that said, you know, you guys have got to go back and look at this again, because it's not clear what you've done. And if it isn't clear what you've done, you could very well have made a mistake that could, you know, cook up this
sure.
kind of thing.
But not that they ruled it out. They simply said, go back and restudy it?
Yeah. Yeah. They said, you know, we're not convinced by your analysis. And that's a bit of a judgment call. I'm not saying that these guys are wrong, because, you know, that's left up to the student to decide.
Sure.
But at this point, it wasn't an obviously correct result, put it that way. And it could very well be something in the data analysis. And in fact, the authors in the paper themselves say that, you know, this should be checked out with other instruments to make sure that it isn't just an instrumental effect. They say that themselves.
Yeah, that's true. They would prefer other groups jump in to help
right,
them.
Right.
Which is
that's the way of science too, by the way. That's, you know, nothing novel in that. I mean, if you make a claim, particularly an extraordinary claim, that there are hundreds of societies spread out around the galaxy, they're all communicating in the same way, they're all tweeting the same thing, then that's a pretty extraordinary claim, and you better check it out with you know, other data.
Seth, what is the protocol if and when you hear these other signals?
Well, if you hear them, I mean, there is a protocol, and it's a very short document. It's a couple of pages long. We've revised
it. It says, call coast to coast and get on the air.
Yeah, well, it might say that, although I don't remember it saying that. But
change it. Make sure it's there, would you?
Well, the problem, George, is that, you know, a lot of people I talk to say, we should call them first. So I don't know. I don't know what to do. But actually, it doesn't work that way anyhow. You don't have to worry you're not going to be first in line, because what really happens, and we've seen it over and over, and we saw it again with this Russian signal, actually, is that the media start calling you. Right? They hear about
it. Oh, of course.
Yeah, they hear about it just as soon as you do, and unless you're the discoverer, in which case, you know, maybe you sit on it for a couple of days. But in general, we've never had any signal that seemed of interest either to us, or either by us, found by us, or found by somebody else, where the media weren't calling within 24 hours. That was maybe the longest time. It was 20 hours, I think. So, in fact, what really happens, forget the protocols, because they're very nice. You know, They're great. You can frame them and hang them on the wall. Not that I've done that, but you could. But in the real world, if you get a signal that's interesting, what happens is the media start calling and want to know about it, and you're telling them, look, we haven't checked it out yet.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the Russian signal. This happened before Labor Day.
Yes.
That the Russians used some kind of mammoth radio telescope in the Caucasus Mountains.
Right.
And they picked up, what did they pick up?
Well, they had the telescope fixed. This is a big telescope. I've actually been there. It's called the Rattan 600, which to me sounds like some motor oil additive or something. but in fact,
or a racetrack.
Yeah, or race. That's right, stock car race. This week competing in the Rattan 600. But I don't know what Rattan stands for. I'm sure
that's a sponsor, probably.
Yeah, well, it could be. I'm sure it means something in Russian. But 600 refers to the fact that this thing is almost 600 meters, so that's 600 yards roughly across. It's big. But it's not totally filled in. It's a funny thing. You can look at pictures of it on the web. I've actually been there, George. Many, many years ago, I visited this thing, and it was back in the Soviet era, and it was really Soviet engineering. It had lots of rivets and, you know, big cranks that these very hefty women would crank the telescope to point it in different directions. Anyhow, so it's kind of an old thing. So they've been using it in a way where it just points kind of straight up. Or if not straight up, it points at one spot, and it just waits for the Earth to rotate to bring something into the beam of the antenna, as it were, so that the antenna can pick it up. So they were doing that for a couple of dozen nearby stars known to have planets, weren't finding anything. And then this one star, which was, what was it, HD 164595, I'm not sure, I think that's right. It's a wonderful name.
Who would question you?
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, probably on the driver's license, that's the name that's given, HD 164595. Anyhow, they found a signal that came from this thing, and it looked like a signal that you would, you know, the kind of signal you would expect. But they looked a total of 39 times, and they found the signal once. So when I got an inquiry from a science reporter on a Saturday night, I was sitting here doing important work. I think I was playing Free Cell, whatever. And I get this email saying, is this legit? And it was a reference to a blog about this signal. And to be honest, right away it sounded to me, oh, that really sounds like a, you know, a communication.
You really need to hear it repeatedly, don't you?
Yeah. If they only find it once and the other 38 times they don't find it, you know, you say, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem right. So, but immediately there was this tremendous interest. I mean, it was still the weekend, and there were people calling me, you know, left, right, and center, and I'm sure they were calling other people, not just me. And we spent time with the Allen Telescope Array. We tried looking for it. We didn't find it. The guys at the University of California, Berkeley, used an even bigger antenna. They didn't find it. And the Russians eventually put out a statement about 4 days later from the Russian Academy of Sciences, saying that, well, it was just a military satellite.
That hurt it.
That's what they said.
Yeah.
And, you know.
So they backtracked.
Well, I don't think that they ever claimed it in the first place. It wasn't reported by the Russians, actually. The Russians said that they had found the signal once and 39 times, but they didn't say anything more about it. And it was reported, actually, by an Italian astronomer who sent me and a bunch of other people emails about this. Here's the thing. I mean, the Russians are not dumb. They're not stupid. You know, they're very competent scientists. And if they thought it was real, they wouldn't just sort of forget about it for a year, which is...
Oh, no, that would be a huge story there.
Right, exactly. They would just call people up around the world and say, hey, you guys, check this out. And they didn't do that.
What's interesting is you are getting these anomalies, whether it's one time or several. Strange things are happening out there in the universe.
Well, I'm sure of that. I'm sure that we find strange things all the time. But I don't think this was one of them. I think this was something strange happening about 200 miles overhead.
Yeah. Well, that's true. There is a lot of interference, you know, from the Earth, isn't there?
Well, it's incessant. I mean, look, if you live in a dark place, you know, if you're one of the 10% of the human race that lives someplace where the sky is pretty dark, just go out and look at the sky. Just stare at any spot on the sky for, you know, 10 minutes, and you'll see satellites moving around.
You'll see things. There's no doubt. Okay, let's talk about the Tabby star. What do we know here?
Yeah, Tabby star, that's in the news now. It's called Tabby Star because the lead researcher in finding this phenomenon about this star is named Tabitha Boyajian. I'm not sure where she puts the accent. I actually asked
A
her.
nice Armenian name.
Yeah, well, she said she herself has trouble pronouncing it, but very nice. I think
I would have called her Bojajian.
Well, you probably know how to pronounce it better than I do. But
Tabitha.
Well, anyhow, Tabitha, but, you know, she goes by Tabby, and she led the team that actually turned this thing up. It was observed by NASA's NASA's
Kepler.
Yeah, space telescope. And what Kepler does is just measure the brightness of stars. Hundreds of thousands, more than 100,000 stars. It's just looking for planets. That's what it's doing.
If they see shadows, they figure there's a planet there.
If they see that the star suddenly gets, you know, a tenth of a percent dimmer for a few hours and then gets bright again, and it does that repeatedly every, I don't know, 50 days or something
right.
like that, then they know it's a planet. But this one didn't fit into that category. It didn't seem to have any, you know, recurring dimming. But it did have some non-recurring dimming that was considerable. In one case, it dimmed by 22%.
Huge.
That is incredible. I mean, you can take Jupiter and put it in front of that star, and it's not going to dim by more than 1%. So this was 22%. That's not a planet anymore. I don't know what that is. Nobody knew what that was. And, you know, then it got dim occasionally. Again, not quite as much, but it was obviously, you know, somebody was flipping the dimmer switch on this star. And that's hard to do. Stars don't do that. They really don't do that. So nobody knew what it was. The people who found it, Tabby and her team, you know, they suggested, well, it's maybe some dust clouds there, maybe comets, maybe something. And a fellow by the name of Jason Wright at Penn State said, well, you know, maybe. But on the other hand, you shouldn't rule out the possibility that what it really is an alien megastructure. It's just something really big.
Like that Dyson sphere,
like
right?
A Dyson sphere, for example, that some really, you know, advanced aliens in that system built. So,
Media went nuts.
Well, people went nuts. Yes, they did. The media went nuts, and we began looking at it with the Allen Telescope Array, and other people began looking at it to see if we could find signals. The trouble is, a couple of troubles, the main trouble is that this star is far away. It's 1,500 light years, more or less, away. And that means it's very hard to learn much about it because it's so far away. And indeed, we didn't find any signals, but, you know, at that distance, it doesn't set a very interesting limit. In other words, the signals would be so weak after 1,500 light years that the fact that we didn't find them doesn't really rule out too much. So Tabby Star remains a mystery. However, there has been a claim. There have been two interesting claims. One is that there's another case very much like Tabby Star. So if you find a second one, you begin to think, might be nature, not advanced aliens. And the second thing is that there's a guy in Australia who uses Kepler, and he thinks it might just be an instrumental problem.
Ah,
yeah, but I don't know whether that's true or not. I haven't heard any other Kepler people weigh in on that. But
well, you and I talked 13 years ago about how the primordial soup in the universe is the same, that there's going to be a lot of similarities. There has to be, just by probability. Remember that?
Well, yeah, George, I barely remember dinner last night. I think I had it, but
I'm pretty sure it was you. But yeah, we talked about how the universe has the same randomness to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the universe is kind of homogeneous in the sense that, indeed, you can look at the farthest galaxies, which are pretty darn far. The stars in them are made of the same stuff as everything around
That's
here.
Right.
The physics, the chemistry, it's the same everywhere, and there's a lot of everywhere. So I think what you're saying there is that if it could happen here, it could happen anywhere else. And I think any scientist...
I think every star system has its own series of planets, for example.
Well, maybe not every, but almost every, yeah.
That is amazing. It truly is. Seth, stay with us. We're going to take this break in just a moment. Seth Shostak with us from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In the final hour of the program, we will take your phone calls with him, but I'll be back with more. And welcome back to Coast to Coast with Seth Shostak from SETI, of course. Seth, let's talk about this other planet, that possibly habitable planet that they're talking about at Proxima Centauri, only, what, 4.2 light years away?
Yeah, that's pretty close.
That is close.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be so close if he had to drive it, but it's the closest other star system to us. I mean, obviously excepting the Sun. So there's the Alpha Centauri system, and then there's this third star. The Alpha Centauri system consists of two stars. It's a double star, but there may actually be a triple star. Nobody's quite sure. There's this Proxima Centauri, and it's actually the closest star. And people have been trying for a long time to find planets around it. Actually, it's very hard. This planet's not too big, but it goes around, I think, in 11 days. You know, you'd have a lot of birthdays at least if you
how many?
You lived on that planet. Yes, you'd have a lot of birthdays every 11 days. You'd have to bake a cake. But it's a dim star, so being in this very tight orbit, which of course an 11-day orbit is actually a good thing, because that means you get enough, you know, energy from this dim star to keep your oceans liquid if you have any, and, you know, stay warm. So it may be a habitable world. I think the most interesting thing about it is that it's you know, if you're going to send something into space, if you really want to go to the stars and not just to Mars, then this is the obvious target. This the other planet around a nearest other star.
Seth, what continues to drive scientists like yourself, like these others who have been conducting these studies? Why do they keep doing this? What are you looking for, really?
Well, you know, if you talk to scientists, why do you do this? Because, after all, you know, you're usually sitting in an office all day reading papers or whatever, or doing an experiment and that sort of thing, and very often research has no obvious benefit. A lot of research, basic research, I mean, even the Higgs boson, you know, billions of dollars were spent to do the Higgs boson. And you could say, well, they found it, but, you know, how's my life different now? And you could say, well, it probably isn't very different. Not yet. Maybe never. But
maybe never.
Maybe never. But that's, you know, not the way it usually works. What usually happens is basic research, it may take 50 years or 100 years, but it can change everything. I think that if you ask the scientists, though, why they're doing it, it's not because they think, oh, well, you know, this might be like the discovery of electricity. You know, nobody figured out what to do with it for a long time, but then they did, and it's changed everything. They're not thinking in those terms so much. Most of them are just doing it because they find it interesting to be the first to learn something that nobody in the history of humankind ever knew.
Is SETI adapting, changing? I mean, it's not the same as it was when you first started, is it?
No, it's not. And a lot of it has to do with, there are two things that change. I mean, one, the astronomy changes in the sense that we didn't know whether planets were common or not. And as you said in the first half here, you know, and just about every star probably has planets, certainly a very high percentage of them, 70%, 80%. We don't know exactly, but, you know, it's the majority. So planets are very common. There are more planets than stars, and there are a lot of stars. So that's
many, many, many.
Yeah, and you could say, well, how does that change anything? Well, it is helpful to know that at least there's enough real estate for aliens to be out there, right? That isn't a problem. So there's that. The other thing that's changed is that the equipment, which is, you know, largely computer-based stuff, it has gotten much faster or cheaper for the same capability. But fundamentally what's happened is that you can do searches much more quickly than you could before. You can look for different kinds of signals than you could before. That's mostly the development of computers. So the experiment gets better, and the science gets better. That's what changes.
You do not believe that we've been visited from these extraterrestrials, do you?
No, I don't think the evidence for that is good. You know, because we talk about it.
We've talked about it. We've had debates about it.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't think so. I think if I thought that that evidence was good, you know, I don't know, maybe I'd give up SETI and say, well, let's just go, you know, try and find out whether the aliens are here.
But you do believe they're out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's what keeps driving you, pushing you, and everything else.
Yeah. I think they're big animals in Africa, but it doesn't mean they're here. So, you know.
What's the staff like at SETI these days?
Well, unfortunately, SETI, the actual, you know, search for radio signals, and we also are building equipment to look for flashing laser light. That's very small staff. You're talking about four people, maybe?
That's it.
The SETI Institute, which is, of course, where I work, the SETI Institute has a much larger population of scientists. There's something like 75 or 80 scientists there, but except for those four SETI guys, and I'm one of the SETI guys.
Right, you're the full-timers, right?
Yeah, we're the full-timers. But these other guys are full-time too, but they are doing what's called astrobiology. So they're working on, a lot of them are working on, for example, research involving Mars, right?
I mean, and who funds that?
That's, they're kind of entrepreneurial. They write proposals, what are called soft money grants in the science biz. And so they write proposals almost always to NASA. And NASA looks at the grants and maybe funds 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 of them. And so if they get, a grant funded, then they have money to pay themselves and do their work for a couple of years, and then they write more grants.
What about the private sector? Do they fund any of these?
Well, in some cases, the private sector has done, but I think that the difficulty is that the private sector may say, well, studying the history of Mars, did it ever have oceans, rivers, lakes, and so forth? I mean, that's interesting, but the government, NASA's already doing that, so we don't need to get involved.
Right.
In the case of SETI, on the other hand, since the government isn't funding SETI at all.
They used to.
They used to, but up until 1993, that was, a NASA project. There has been some private money. There's a fellow by the name of Yuri Milner. You've probably heard of Breakthrough Listen and Breakthrough Starshot. And he lives up here in Northern California. And he has funded SETI research at the University of California, Berkeley.
He's into this stuff, isn't he?
He is.
That's
yes.
Good. He is. You know what? I think that's great.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. And, you can say, private funding of basic research. But that's the way it was done 200 years ago. I mean, Galileo was privately funded. It wasn't the Italian government, if there was such a thing. He was funded by, the Medicis, a very wealthy family.
So what will be the big breakthrough again, Seth? What's it going to take?
Well, you never know what it's really going to take until you've done it, to be honest. But, trying to be prescient about it, trying to kind of look into a crystal ball and say, what would it take to book success and actually find that signal? Clearly, you need enough money to do the experiment. So, it's money largely. But if you had adequate money, you could build new kinds of receivers that could sort of scan, not just scan the heavens, but scan the heavens over a very wide range of the radio dial very quickly so that you could, you could look for things much more quickly. You could go through maybe 1 million star systems. I just had this gut feeling that if you could look at 1 million star systems, you might find something. And so far, we've looked at a few thousand. You could look at 1 million. You could look at 1 million in 15 or 20 years if you had better receivers. You could do it.
Yeah, you could. Now, Stephen Hawking has warned everybody, be very careful about letting them know, the ETs, that we're here. He's really concerned about that. Are you?
Well, no, I'm not, actually. Maybe Stephen and I part company on this. Actually, I wrote an opinion piece for The Guardian about this a couple of weeks ago. They asked for a piece. And then some other British newspaper said that I was rubbishing Hawking. That's the British term for, dissing him, if you will. But that's not true. I don't have any beef with Stephen Hawking. And I think that what he says is not totally unreasonable. It comes down to this. He says, look, if you find a signal, don't grab the microphone and start broadcasting back, hey, we're the Earthlings, we heard you, because you don't know what's out there, and that's true. And, maybe they're just all very friendly, and, they'll be happy to hear from you. On the other hand, what if you happen to get in touch with a society that, just wants to come stomp out all the competition in this part of the galaxy, and, your tombstone then reads responsible for the obliteration of Earth. I mean, what a bummer. So, that's essentially what he's saying, is that it might be better to lay low. Now, I don't agree with that. The reason I don't agree with that is that we haven't been laying low since the Second World War. We've been broadcasting all sorts of stuff into space, and any aliens that could come here and, wreak havoc and destruction will have the equipment to pick up those signals. So I think it's too late to worry about it.
Seth, what would you recommend to upcoming scientists who want to get involved in this kind of work?
Well, first off, I would say that you have a better chance of becoming an astronaut, frankly. You're just looking around at the number of job openings, there's that. But that's not what I would really say to anybody, because you know, as a kid, I really hated it when somebody said, well, you know, you'd do better to become a dentist because there are a lot more jobs. You know, if you didn't want to become a dentist, then doggone it, you ought to do what you really find interesting. So, you know, people can call me up a lot and say, you know, I'm a student and I want to know, or they send an email, I want to know what courses should I take, what school should I go to so I can have a job, you know, doing this, doing SETI. And there's no secret sauce, George, it's just not. I mean, you know, it helps if you study astronomy or physics or geology or computer science, all the things that we use. I mean, it's, and it really does, as far as which school to go to, you know, I don't think that matters very much, frankly. I probably shouldn't say that, but I don't think it matters very much.
Seth, the work of some of these other scientists, again, with these the new study, claiming that whatever they're hearing is got to be unusual. If you had a meeting with them, what would you be telling them?
Well, I mean, I would tell them, look, okay, you think you may have, you know, you might be onto something here. All right, let's figure out, you know, what instruments can see that part of the sky, and let's go back and spend some time looking at it and see if we can find anything. I mean, that's all you can do. You can sit around and talk about it, have a lot of beers and stuff like that, but in the end, if you don't find it again, you're left with a mystery, and that's never very satisfying.
You speak a lot about SETI, of course, to a lot of groups, young people. What are they looking for? What do they want to hear?
I think people are just interested in the whole idea of extraterrestrial life, and I don't find that particularly remarkable. You could say, oh, it's because of all the TV shows and, you know, the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the other way around. Personally, I think that the movies and the TV shows reflect the fact that people are interested in aliens. And I think it's very primal. I think it's like we're interested in dinosaurs, right? Kids are interested in dinosaurs. They're all interested in dinosaurs. I certainly was. And why is that? You know, do they all want to become paleontologists? Well, probably not. But I think you're kind of hardwired, right, to be interested in anything with big teeth. Because if you're not interested in those kind of animals, maybe you're not around today, you know what I mean? And I think the same is pretty much true with aliens. It's not that aliens are going to bite into you or anything, but, you know, it's like a tribe on the other side of the hill. You have to pay attention to their behaviors because they could cause you, you know, harm. On the other hand, maybe you could, you know, mate with one of them. I mean, I don't know, but I think it pays to be interested in your peers.
Do we have this inherent drive and need to want to be able to say that there are extraterrestrials there?
I don't know.
I don't think we want to be alone.
Yeah, I think that there's truth in that. I think there's truth in that. I mean, there's some people who say, I don't care. Don't waste time looking for these aliens. I don't care. I've got my own problems. Well, of course, everybody's got their own problems. But the majority of people, at least the ones I talk to, and who knows, that's a very, you know, kind of objective group of people. But they just want to know. They just want to know. They want to know, you know, we're on this tiny rock and we're in one part of a kind of nondescript galaxy in a very vast universe. I mean, is this it? You know, or is there somebody else out there too?
Will we find out? I think so.
Yep. Well, I hope so. Yeah, I really do, George.
I mean, you've been at it for how long now?
Well, I've been at the SETI Institute since, I think, 1990 or 91, something like that. And
hey, you'll never retire.
Well,
we need you.
Yeah, right. Well, you can talk to my relatives about that. But
you love doing what you're doing.
Well, of course. I mean, you know,
I can tell.
Yeah, you don't do it for much else. It's a psychic income, as they like to describe it.
Tell me about the technology. Of course, the Paul Allen array, is that complete now? Is that all finished? And you just mentioned something about lasers.
Yeah, well, the Paul Allen array, or it's just called the Allen Telescope Array, or we call it the ATA. It's located in Northern California here, even farther north than where I am. I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, Silicon Valley. But the Allen Telescope Array is further up, even farther up north in California, the Cascades. It's about 300 miles north of San Francisco. You can go visit it. Anybody who's interested could go visit it. It's open during the week, and they just go in and, you know, take a look at it. But it's working, but it's an array, which is to say it consists of 42 antennas, each of which is about 20 feet in diameter, the big dish. So, you know, that's reasonable size. It's not huge. you know, the Russians just fired up a telescope where the dish diameter is 500 meters, which is like, you know, 1500 feet. I mean, it's like, I don't know, half a kilometer or something diameter. It's very big. So, but there are 42 of them. The idea was to build hundreds of them, and we haven't done that. That's a money problem. With adequate money,
A hundred would allow you to do what?
well, to begin with 100, you could look at many more patches on the sky at once.
Okay.
Not that each one is looking at a different patch on the sky. It's just the way you combine the signals.
So you could look at these 234 spots that the
Well, I don't
people
know. They're
okay.
probably not all in one spot, part of the
They're
sky.
everywhere.
Yeah, they're probably all over the sky. But you could, and we probably will look at some of them anyhow. But the other advantage of having more antennas is that the whole system is very much more sensitive. So you could find weaker signals, and that's important.
Well, why does it just take Paul Allen to do this? How come other people aren't jumping on board?
Yeah, well, I wish I knew the answer to that question because maybe I could do something about it. I think the part of the difficulty, and when it comes to funding these things, is that you can't guarantee a result. Now, you know, if you could go in and say, look, for X amount of money, we will find that signal.
You can't do that.
But you can't do that. And so it's a bit of a gamble. It's like playing the slots in Las Vegas. You know, there's no guarantee.
Why did NASA decide to stop funding?
Well, that was a political move by a congressman, a senator actually from Nevada. Richard Bryan was his name, and I can use his name because
He's gone now.
he's gone now. Yeah, I could have used his name before, but you know, he wasn't actually so interested in SETI. He didn't know really much about SETI, but he was looking for something that would help his campaign for re-election.
And he probably headed up the Appropriations Committee or something.
Well, I don't know that he did, but he made a kind of a campaign to find something that he could point to as a symbolic of government waste. I mean, mind you, this was taking 3 cents out of everybody's tax returns per year, the whole SETI
I'd
program.
rather give it to you than anybody else in government. Trust me.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, but be that as it may, he told NASA, don't do this anymore, so NASA stopped the funding right away. And yeah, and it hasn't been in the NASA budget since. Mind you,
Can it get back in?
well, you know, the amendment that killed NASA SETI was just for that year. It wasn't forever, but to get back into the NASA budget is actually quite hard because, you know, the NASA budget is already
Right.
bursting at the seams, and so you have to gore somebody else's
That's
office,
right. It's easier to
basically.
take out than put back,
Right.
to be
Yeah,
sure.
that's a problem. There are people in Congress who have interests.
Do you have a fundraising drive or anything like that?
We do. Yeah, we do. I mean, we have to because otherwise.
I mean, you should have people like, Jeff Bezos from Amazon and Elon Musk. Those people should be contributing.
Well, I don't disagree with you, George.
All right, Seth, stay with us. We're going to come back. Final hour to go just ahead on Coast to Coast AM. That means your phone calls. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, if you would. And you can do all that by going to coasttocoastam.com.